Hey everybody, Jimmy Alcoholic.
Hey.
Grateful to be alive and sober, and it's customary where I come from to let you know that I have a home group. It's called the Design for Living Group on the Jersey Shore.
It's all right.
No, I was waiting for nice, right? I remember that. Nice. I have a sponsor named Bob Bizance from St. Paul, Minnesota. Sponsor a lot of guys, but most importantly, I've been sober since my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was on March 28, 1987. So extremely grateful for this way of life, extremely grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous, and really great to be here this weekend. John, thank you for the invite. I think you invited me. I don't know. It seems so long ago, but it really wasn't. And thanks for the committee, you guys, putting this together. I love retreats. I'll talk a lot about that throughout the weekend. But thank you, John, for the ride from the pickup. Learned a lot about John. I didn't want to tell him this, but a lot of these guys called me and they were happy that you moved back to Long Island. But you know, John, you know, we went out for breakfast and we had pizza. And little jokes here, you know. John said to me at one point, you know, you're from Jersey. I said, yeah. He goes, do you know any gangsters like Tony Soprano? And I said, John, I'm from the Jersey Shore. I only know people like Snooki, J-Well, you know. Yeah, you got to be over under 30 to know that one, okay? But I'm just really grateful to be here and, honored. Let me stop my clock because I know I'll screw that up. So I'm about 3 months sober, and my sponsor comes up to me in a meeting and he says, you going on a retreat? And I said, no, I'm not. And total fear when he said that to me. And right away with the excuses, well, I don't have any money. He goes, don't worry about it. You have a scholarship. And I said, I had no luggage. He goes, don't worry. You live out of a bag. Just put your clothes in a bag. And I go off to North Jersey, and I go to this thing called the Matt Talbert Retreat. I don't know if you guys have that down here, but it's just a bunch of alcoholics. It's usually facilitated by a recovering priest or a deacon or, you know, someone of a religious order. You know, now they have lay people doing it. And so me and two other guys, we all three of us had 90 days, and we go up to this retreat house up in northern New Jersey, and I'm terrified because I don't know what I'm going to walk into. I have no idea what a retreat is. I really just clueless on what you guys do here. And I remember even walking past the door or the window, and I looked in. I see you guys sitting around. I think you're taking a test. You're eating dinner. That's how out of my mind I was, you know. But something happened to me on that weekend, something that I'll never forget in the rest of my life. And what it was the conversation you guys were having with each other. There was a love, there was a transparency, there was something going on that I didn't understand. Because you see, I come off the streets. And you see, I don't know how to talk to a man. I don't know how to have a conversation like this. I don't know how to look a man eye to eye. You know, my head's always down. I'm filled with shame and guilt, remorse. I'm 3 months sober, but I'm a mess still, you know? So I don't know what, you know, how to have a normal conversation. I grunt a lot. How you doing, Jimmy? You know, that's about it, you know? But what I witnessed was that weekend was the transparency, the love. But more importantly, I saw something new that I didn't know what it was until years later, really. And it was peace. You guys had a peace inside you. In the midst of all your troubles, in the midst of all your, you know, family problems, in the midst of all your work problems, in the midst of all your relationship problems, in the midst of all your adversities in life, guess what? You were in here talking about that stuff, you know? And that's why I was excited when I found out that you're going to break up into small groups rather than just, you know, let's just go walk around, the place around here, you know, because that's where I found the magic, you know? I'm just a small part in the wheel here today. I mean, this weekend, you know, I think what really happens, my experience is in these small groups when we start to talk about what's really going on, you know, and to be willing or be bold and or brave enough or have the courage enough to talk about, you know, because you see, the amount of time we have sober is really besides the point. It's nice I'm sober 38 years, but I didn't get on a rocket ship on day one and go up, up, and away. I've crashed and burned in Alcoholics Anonymous more than anyone, right? And I think really that's what happens to a lot of us. We grow, we hit walls, we grow, we hit walls. And I think it's these constant surrenders that we have to have that, you know, really turn us back to God. And the only way we really get through that is with each other. So that's the importance of this deal for me. You know, I was hoping somebody was here for the first time, you know. But if it's anyone in here, I've always said this, you know, and I know it was important to me, you know. If there's something that's tugging on your heart, grab your sponsor, grab a friend, grab a stranger, grab me, and let's talk about what's going on. Because really, that's what I found out at these retreats, is that, you know, we all, no matter how long we're sober, need to put the spiritual mirror up to ourselves once in a while, right? Get down to causes and conditions and some of the things that are blocking me from God. It's really easy to say, you know, everything is great, you know, and then qualify that by saying, well, I go to 6 meetings a week, I have 5 sponsors, I make coffee at the Tuesday night meeting, I got all these commitments, but I'm dying in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm dying of this thing called untreated alcoholism sometimes. You know, the liquor is just a symptom. And sometimes, you know, I got these things going on in my life. I don't even recognize them. I don't even see them until I sit down with a guy like you or guys like you, you know. So one of the things I saw in here that I was reading here about retreats, you know, it talks about, you know, even though people come to retreats and have an honest desire to stay sober, they're always plagued by some of the following problems. And I like this because maybe this will hit one of you between the eyes. Number one, I'm having trouble with the spiritual side of the program. I'm a fellowship guy. I like going to meetings. I like drinking your coffee. I like looking at the pretty girls. But this thing about God, this thing about the steps, I don't know about that. I'm not sure if I really want that. The second thing, I would like to have a higher power working in my life, but I don't know how to do this. You know, I go to my sponsor and I tell him about my problems, and what he tells me is pray on it. Let go and let God. I don't know how to do that. How do you let go and let God? How is that accomplished? Third thing, I ask my higher power for guidance every morning, yet I'm not happy. And I show no improvement in my behavior and my thinking. What am I doing wrong? You know, I walk into a meeting like this tonight and my mind tells me everyone's doing great here because I don't know any of you. You know, but the truth of the matter is these questions open up some doors sometimes. And the last one is sometimes it seems like everyone else is changing and getting some serenity. I just feel angry and left out. Nothing pisses me off than someone who comes in after me and gets better before me. How's he doing that? As you hear my story, that's, you know, that's my story. So, you know, if you find yourself in any of those things, again, get into your group, talk about this stuff. You know, I'm here to let you know, and a lot of you guys already know this, that AA works and God is real. And sometimes we have to come to a place like this to just remind ourselves of that. That AA works and God is real. Right? So, you know, my sponsor, when I first sat down to do the steps, you know, he said, you know, open your book to the first page. Right? Now I'm a smart guy, right? So I go to page one. He goes, I didn't say that. I said, first page. And as many of you probably know, the first page is a blank page, right? It's the first page in the book. He says to me, this is what you know about recovery. Absolutely nothing. And he wasn't saying that to knock me down or anything like that. He was just telling me that whenever we go into the book and have a new experience, let's put everything aside that you think you know so we could have this new experience, so we could see some truth about ourselves, right? And a lot of people write, you know, a prayer on that page. A lot of people write the set-aside prayer on that page. My sponsor asked me to write these three questions down on this page. First question, how are you showing up? How are you showing up as a father? How are you showing up as a husband? How are you showing up as a sibling? How are you showing up on the job with your coworkers? How are you showing up in traffic? How are you showing up in a grocery store? How are you showing up at your AA business meeting? Right? Not only that, how are you showing up financially? Right? Am I still on the chase for the shiny objects and living under the delusion that if I just get this external stuff, this internal problem's going to go away, this unmanageability that I suffer from? Am I under that delusion still? So how are you showing up, he asked me. Right? Put the spiritual mirror up to yourself. I want to tell you I'm a great dad, but sometimes I'm not a great dad. I want to tell you I'm a great husband, but really I'm not a great husband. I want to tell you a lot of things about myself, but it'd all be lies because I'm not showing up very good. I'm disconnected from God. You know, I fall into that blind spot. A lot of us fall into that blind spot. Here, God, here's the drink problem, but I'll handle the rest of my life trying to control and manage my life on my terms. It caused a lot of problems in my life. Second question, are you being accountable? Right? To who? Well, how about a sponsor? What's that look like to have a conversation with my sponsor? Right? Or is it just a quick get in and get out so he doesn't ask me any hard questions like, what are you doing? How are you acting? What's going on in your relationship with your wife? Right? Or is it just a quick dump and I'm out? Am I accountable to the guys I sponsor? Do Well, I talk to the men I sponsor. Right? Am I accountable to my family? Am I accountable to my job? I mean, simple question, but how am I being accountable? It's really easy to sleepwalk through my sobriety. I know that. I've done that. Right? I'm dead awake sometimes, sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then the final question he asked me was, are you being of service to God and others? And what does that really look like? Yeah, we sponsor people. We have commitments in our meetings. Maybe some of us belong to the church and we do commitments in that, or maybe some civic responsibilities. But how are you showing up? And what I didn't understand when he was doing this was he was trying to set me up for a lifetime of inventory, of putting the spiritual mirror up to myself and seeing where I am today. It's really easy to hang for me. I'm speaking for myself. It's really easy for me to hang my hat on how long I've been here. But man, I had fallen short. So these questions that he asked me were really pertinent and really important. And I kind of like really, you know, as I look at it, it really becomes a prayer life. Because if I ask myself those questions at the end of the day and I really think about it, is any of the stuff that's going on in my life objectionable? Am I willing to change any of the things in my life for tomorrow to be a different, better, or a better person tomorrow? The guy that goes to bed angry wakes up angry. Am I willing to clear the deck before I hit the rack? Right. So these were just simple questions he started to ask me. So, you know, I always like to tell them, I'm going to tell my story for a time tonight and just talk about me a little bit so you guys get to know me a little bit. You know, I always like to say I was born perfect and I was quickly handed over to these two character defects called mom and dad. Kind of a joke, but the truth of the matter is it their fault? It's always somebody's fault. That's the type of guy I am. I blame everyone. I blame everyone for what goes on in my life. And my parents obviously were the first ones out of the chute, and they were the best ones to blame. And all my parents ever did for me was try to give me morals, values, a good education. And what I did for my parents was I rolled everything of goodness they ever tried to give me into a nice little ball, and I stuffed it right down my parents' throat, and I introduced my parents to a way of life that they never even knew existed. You know, I grew up in northern New Jersey. I grew up on the Hudson, New Jersey side of the Hudson River overlooking Manhattan. I'm 67 years old. You know, I grew up in the 60s, really, and it was just a tough neighborhood. It was a blue-collar neighborhood. It isn't like it is today with all the office buildings and everything else. Everyone was a cop. Everyone was a fireman. Everyone was a union worker, truck driver, warehouse worker, criminal. I mean, it was just blue-collar, you know? And in these neighborhoods that we were growing up, or the neighborhood I grew up, the only requirement for membership was five or more kids. So every house had tons of kids. Every house had, you know, and with all these kids and all these big families, there was always an occasion that's going on. Birthday party, christening, a barbecue, you name it. And at every event was king alcohol. Now, you'll hear this saying quite often that alcoholism is the disease of perception. The way I look at alcohol is I equate alcohol to fun. I'm 6, 7, 8 years old. I watch my old man. I watch my uncles, my brothers, the neighbors. It seems like there's some ease and comfort at once that comes at once when you guys start to drink. You laugh, you have fun, you horse around. That looked attractive to me as a young kid. You know, I'd see my mom and her friends, they'd be drinking whatever they're drinking, laughing, having a good old time. So right out of the gate, I equate alcohol to fun, to freedom, to problem solved. It just seems like something's going on that maybe one day I can't wait to do. Now, I'm living in this house, and I got this guy called Dad. Dad's cunning, baffling, and powerful. My old man's a tough guy. My old man is a war vet. I mean, we would tag him with PTSD today. He just comes from that generation. He would have been about like 98, 100 years old by now, you know. Hard worker, provider, put five of us through major universities in the United States. But my dad's a lunatic. My dad's violent. My dad drinks, and you never know what's going on. But at 5 o'clock, every 5 o'clock, every night, my dad would walk in. My mom would make these two pitchers, one called martinis and the other one called Manhattans. And what I would witness, again, 6, 8, 10 years old, is the ease and comfort that comes by once by taking a drink, because my father would take that drink and he became a different person. He became a guy that wanted to have a catch in the backyard. He became a guy that had a few jokes. He became a guy that shared an emotion or even talked about his day. But don't let me fool you. There were those days. Those days look like this. My old man would take that drink and all of a sudden kitchen plates would be flying across the kitchen. Kitchen chairs would be flying across the kitchen. You know, if you grabbed one of us young kids, we'd be flying across the kitchen. So a lot of nights in my house growing up, around 5:01, we'd be under the covers. Me, my two brothers, and my two sisters, waiting for the tornado to roar through the house. And then when it all ended and got quiet, we'd walk out into the living room, walk out into the kitchen, Hey, Mom, ain't it grand? The wind stopped blowing. And we would never discuss what just went on in my house. Now, none of that makes me alcoholic. But I'm a kid that grows up with a tremendous amount of fear. Fear of big people, fear of noises, fear of violence, fear of getting hit, fear, the evil and corroding threat. I'm a kid that grows up with a tremendous amount of insecurity about myself and inadequacies about myself. It isn't like my old man ever sat me down and had a fireside chat about life. You know, everything I ever learned was really on the streets. You know, so there was this feeling that I had about me that I don't know where that really came from. Maybe that's called alcoholism. But worst of all, I'm a kid that grows up with a lot of secrets. You see, if you live in my house, you don't talk about what's going on outside your house. You live in my neighborhood, you don't even talk about what's going on in your neighborhood, outside your neighborhood. So from a young age, I learned how to start internalizing and pushing this stuff down, right? And by the time I'm 13 years old, I'm a time bomb. I'm crazy already. By the time I'm 13, I'm acting out in every possible way. But I find myself 54 years ago in a cemetery with five guys. I know them to this day. And I'm about to take my first drink at the age of 13 years old. And here comes that first bottle. It's called Colt 45 Malt Liquor. And I reach in there and I grab the neck of that bottle with a tremendous amount of fear. Because I don't know what's going to happen, but I wanted to take a drink. Here comes that second bottle called Mohawk Blackberry Brandy. And I start drinking on that blackberry brandy. What I could tell you about my first night drinking is I blacked out. I puked purple for about 2 weeks. My father beat the crap out of me and my mother grounded me for life. But the hook was in. I found the magic elixir. I found that thing that we all found in this room. That's why we're here. That thing that settled this thing down. And I don't know what this thing is. It's just that this thing inside of me, this old timers used to say this all the time. Alcoholism is a soul sickness caused by a separation from God and a disconnect from each other. This soul sickness that I suffer from, which I didn't know back then at 13 years old, I just know when I poured Colt 45 and Mohawk Blackberry Brandy on that, I had the time of my life. Little did I know that I just stepped on a path for the next 16 years of my life that would go to straight to pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. And if you don't know what those big words mean, it means hell. Now, that doesn't mean I didn't have a great time drinking. I had a great time until it wasn't great. I mean, I did everything, you know, concerts, ball games, barbecues, trips down the shore. I mean, all the things we do growing up, man, I had a blast. I had a blast until it wasn't a blast anymore, you know? And as alcoholism is progressive, another thing is very progressive, my behaviors. You see, I grew up in an age when your mom would open up the door at 8 o'clock in the morning, boot us all out, right? She knew you'd eat somewhere and you'd come home eventually, you know? It was a safe time back then. But everything I ever learned was on the streets. And I started to mimic the guys that were older than me. I wanted to be like the guys who were older than me. I didn't understand that I'm a chameleon from day one, really. Always pretending to be somebody I'm not. Always want to fit in. Always want to be part of rather than separate from. So I started to get involved with these guys that are doing all sorts of illegal stuff. And I started to get in a lot of trouble, you know, stealing, robbing. We used to rob freight trains. I mean, we did all the kind of stuff that you would do. And don't think anything's wrong with that. Nobody ever told me right and wrong. I mean, I knew right and wrong. I just didn't, you know. It was, being part of that, feeling that, was more important than doing right. And little by little, when my behavior's getting worse, my drinking's getting worse, you know, I'm dying of this thing, and I don't even know that I'm dying of it. You know, I go off to a university in Pennsylvania. I don't even last a year. I get thrown out of this university because I don't even go to class. I'm just drinking around the clock. And I come back to New Jersey, and what's a boy to do? You know, I have no trade. I have no education. I have no real hook into a union job. And so this starts my daily drinking of going down to the corner bar because where I live, there's a corner bar, and there's a bar on every corner. And the drinking age in Jersey back then was 18 years old. And, you know, if you were 15 years old and your chin could hit the top of a bar, you were getting served. And I've been 6'4" since birth, so it was never a problem. And, you know, so, you know, little old man shot in beer places, you know, but that was the life. And I loved every minute of it. I just loved the excitement, the gambling, the drinks, the girls. I just fell right into that, like just putting my hand in a glove. It was so simple for me, you know. And, you know, looking back now, we live life forward. We understand it backwards. Man, I was just running from me the whole time. I didn't understand this disease called alcoholism. I didn't know any of that stuff until I landed and started to meet you guys, you know. So fast forward, you know, life's going on. I'm really doing nothing. I'm down at the corner bar every day trying to figure out my life. Anyone else in here trying to figure out your life while drinking? Well, that was me, you know, and what am I going to do, you know? And, you know, a lot of the guys I hung out with, you know, I'm right across the river from Wall Street. A lot of guys were getting, Wall Street would hire anyone. I mean, Jesus, you know, and these guys were making unbelievable money. So they would, you know, guys were going off to Wall Street in New York, you know, starting, they would meet her, you know, they would start these families. It just seemed like everyone was just moving on with life, and I'm stuck in that bar trying to figure out my life. And, I'm a guy who, you know, I'm like a double-edged sword guy. I'm blaming everyone for my life, but I'm also seeking something out there that I think is going to fix me in here. And a lot of us do that through relationships. And I see a girl in a bar one day. I grab my sister. I say, introduce me to her. And, you know, under the delusion that if I just meet a girl, maybe I'll settle down and get normal somehow, you know. My sister introduces me to this girl. And what happens is 7 months later, I'm engaged and I get married to this woman. I'm 25 years old, 26 years old at the time. Under the delusion. See, alcoholism doesn't come in a bottle, it comes in my mind. And my mind is filled with a lot of delusions, a lot of distortions. And I buy into every one of them. And one of the biggest delusions is if I could just get this, I'm going to be all right here. The shiny objects. And whether that's cars, money, you know, jewelry, women, whatever the case may be, I am so convinced that if I just get married, I'll settle down. Well, 4 months into the marriage, I walk out of the marriage because what I don't understand about me is I have the inability not to take a drink. King alcohol has me in its grips, but I don't know that. I think I'm doing what everyone else is doing. And 4 months into the marriage, I'm irresponsible. I'm non-caring. I don't like her. I don't like me. I mean, it's a bad mixture, and I walk out of the marriage. I'm 27 years old, I believe, at this time. I always forget the numbers. And I take off of Boca Raton, Florida, where I had a friend and family that was pretty well off living on the beach or in the ocean. And I'll never forget, you know, somewhere along the lines, God cracked my skull open. And in my skull, he put this chalkboard. And on the chalkboard were these three emotions of shame, guilt, and remorse. And it seems like everything that I've done in my life at this point has created some sort of shame. Shame of not being a good son. Shame of not being walking out of a marriage. Shame of failing out of school. Shame, 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 shame. I got a list from here to the back wall of all the things that have created shame. Most outies have shame-based identities. The guilt and the remorse of the things I'm doing, the arrest, the lockups, my mom bailing me out, on and on and on, right? And all the things I've done to hurt people in my life, walking out on this woman. I laid her out with that decision. And I'm down here in Florida. And I'm in this condo. And I'm getting that knock every day. Four horsemen showing up. Terror, frustration, bewilderment, despair. Bill Wilson gives us 1,000,001 adjectives of our state of mind. Drinking and not drinking at times. Restless, irritable, discontent. But you see, I still have an answer in my life. It's called Johnny Walker Red, and all I need to do is crack the seal of a bottle, and I can feel the grandiosity already coming back. And when I take that drink, yep, it's her fault. It's my parents' fault. It's someone's fault. It's always somebody's fault for the way I feel inside. So I decide to come back to New Jersey, and you know, this decision I made was to, like, just lay low and try to figure out my life again. And I come back to New Jersey, and I was going to stay in this guy's house, and I never stayed in this house. And what happened to me was for the next 19 months of my life, I lived on the streets of northern New Jersey and lower Manhattan, doing what we call the aimless walk. Traumatic. Dehumanizing. I don't even have enough adjectives to tell you what it was like living on the streets. And if you lived on the streets, you would know that one night on the streets is one night too many for anyone. And selling my blood and doing things and getting, if I took a ball or a basketball that was made out of glass and I just threw it down on this tile, it would shatter. And that's where I was at 27 years old, 28 years old. No hope, no vision, no nothing. I was a dark soul living on the streets. What am I going to do? Too afraid to call my family. Wanted to call my mother every day because I knew she would bail me out. Didn't never wanted to talk to my old man because that would just turn into violence. So what happened was I walked in a bar one night. And this old guy comes up to me and goes, hey, Jimmy, he knew me from the neighborhood. He goes, they're hiring guys like you. in Newark Airport. Guys like me, huh? Finally, it's being seen for my potential. And what do you want me to do, fly an airplane? I mean, no, there was an airline called People's Express. I don't know if any of you guys remember that airline. They would hire guys like us. And the idea of the job was to take the luggage that was over there and hopefully get it on the plane that was over there. Always like the segue here, and I always say it, you know, if you flew through Newark Airport in the 80s and you're still waiting for your luggage, well, I'll make amends later on. So that next day, me and two guys, we robbed the car. I say borrow, the cops said rob, but the car window was open and the keys were in it. I mean, that's what we used to do. And we go out to Newark Airport. All three of us are now sober over 38 years. All three of us made amends to the guy that we robbed the car off. It was pretty comical how that all turned out. So we go out to Newark Airport that next day, and I'm a mess, beyond a mess. I weigh about 130 pounds, 40 pounds. I look like a twig. I had long hair, believe it or not, back then. I had a big beard. Couldn't even put sentences together. I had no vocabulary. Like I said, I grunted a lot. I turned into my old man. I don't know whatever happened to my education. Went out the window. And we go out to Newark Airport. It's a huge room. You could just imagine the people walking around. And I walked into this office. We had to go in, and it was like kind of a quick, if I remember correctly, it was kind of a quick interview. Like, can you lift the suitcase? Yeah, you're hired. I mean, that was the interview. And I'll never forget, this guy said to me, go sit outside and I'll call you back in. And I went and I sat in a chair just like that. And I couldn't even tell you at the age of 29 years old what I felt in that moment. It wasn't until I landed in here. And I opened up that book. And on page 8, Bill talks about his first step experience. Of no words could tell the loneliness and despair I felt in a bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I met my match. I've been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. And sitting in the middle of Newark Airport with the wind blowing through the hole in my soul, I think I have a drinking problem. Now, a blind man can see that, but aren't we the last to see our problems? When all of a sudden, a complete stranger sat right next to me. And after a couple of minutes, this stranger looked at me and said, hey, what's your problem? And I said, and I spent my life story up on this guy. You know, people weren't asking me how my 401k was doing back then, or that new Porsche I just bought. What's wrong with you? Complete stranger. And I spent my life story up on this guy. Pulls out a piece of paper. He goes, I have the solution for you. And I said, what's that? He wrote down a street on a piece of paper. He goes, you know what this is? I said, that's my old neighborhood. This is pre-cell phone, pre-beeper days. Put a number from that street and asked me a very important question. Is it possible for you not to drink tonight? And I was honest with him. I want to drink right now. He said, try not to drink and be in front of this address at 7 o'clock tonight. And at 7 o'clock that night, in front of that address, with my knees knocking, my stomach turning, my mind going a million miles an hour. Was I even into it? I was so delusional. I was so shot out. I was so sick. A 1979 Chevy Impala pulled up, and a stranger was driving the car, and there was a few other strangers in that car. And they rolled down the window, and they said, the most spiritual thing you'll ever hear in Alcoholics Anonymous, get in the car. And I got in the car with these gentlemen, and they took me around the corner to my grammar school, where I had all sorts of contempt towards God, towards Catholicism, it was a Catholic school, towards anything of goodness. I hated, because I hated me, but I didn't know how much I hated me, and I hated you. And they walked me into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was on March 28, 1987. I've been sober ever since. Now, that doesn't mean I've been well ever since. But what happened was when they walked me into that meeting, something occurred to me. I think every person that's in here, well, maybe I shouldn't say that. I believe many of us have a moment in our lives when we get sidetracked from what we're really supposed to be living. And in my case, it might be a small little deal, but I remember being in fifth grade, right? I'm in a public school system. I have friends. There seemed to be an ease and comfort hanging out with guys in the schoolyard. We played every sport imaginable you could play, you know? And my parents made a decision to take me out of the public school system where I knew everyone and put me across town into the Catholic school system where I knew nobody. And the square peg in a round hole shows up. And all of a sudden, I'm around all these people, and I'm 13 years old, and this is when I take that first drink. Do they have anything to do with each other? I'm sure they do. But here I am walking into that school, and I'm walking past the cafeteria, a room that kind of looks like this, you know? And I remember thinking, man, I had goals, I had dreams, I had aspirations. I wanted to be somebody. I didn't want to be a union worker like my own. And I wound up being a union worker. I had a great career for a short time. You know, everything was good. I had no complaints, but I wanted something better for myself. You know, and as I walked down to the end of that hallway, man, I smelled the coffee in the air, and that's being generous because back in AA world back then, we used to drink Sanka. I don't know if any of you guys remember that crap. You know, it was like what the astronauts drank on the moon. I mean, it was terrible. But I met the most important person you'll ever meet in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we call him the greeter. And that gentleman extended his hand to me, and I grabbed that flimsy reed, and he pulled me into you. And what I know today was that was the loving and powerful hand of God pulling me into you. And walking into my first meeting was like a grammar school reunion. I thought you died. I thought you were in jail. I mean, it was unbelievable, this sense of knowing people at my first meeting. And, you know, I'm not going to bore you with my whole drunken log and story like that, but, you know, my life starts in Alcoholics Anonymous. That stranger became my sponsor that day, on day one. That group I walked into became my home group. So on day one, I had a sponsor and a home group, and I didn't even know what they were, you know. Took away the interview process, but, you know, I was planted, you know. And back then, we weren't reading this book. Not my neighborhood, you know. The meetings in my neighborhood were speaker meetings, discussion meetings. We didn't read the big book until Joe and Charlie came through the Northeast in Harlem, New York, especially in 1991. That's when we all got lit up like Christmas trees and started to use the book like a weapon, you know, like, you better do it this way. No, I wasn't, but you better do it, you know. So, you know, so the guys I got around were really old. They were like 45 years old. I mean, they had, but they were, that's a joke. No, but they were a different generation. These were guys that had jobs for 15 years. They were married. They already had two kids. I mean, but I like to call it the kindness of strangers. They might not have known the difference between a phone book and a big book, but if you ever needed anything, they'd be at your front door. You know, and what they did for me, these guys, on day one, is they put me up in a motel. They pooled their money together, and they put me in a motel for a week, and they went to a department store. They bought me sneakers, jeans, T-shirts. You know, they would drive them everywhere. You know, they were kindness of strangers, man. These guys, they didn't know me. They knew the importance of carrying a message to the alcoholic who still suffers. They knew the importance of being there for the newcomer when he walked through that front door. Because those were guys that were watching the door all the time. You know, and so I started to get around these guys. And on day two, I wake up in this motel. I want to drink right away because that's all I know how to do. And this guy, Richie, who becomes my sponsor, comes and I share an emotion. You might think that's quite strange, but I'm so shut down emotionally. And I'm a guy on the streets, and I believe by the code of the streets, real men don't share anything. Real men don't talk about anything. You know, you just push it down until it blows up. But that's the kind of guy I am. And Richie pulls up, and I tell him I'm scared. That's like, you don't say stuff like that where I come from. I'm scared. Why are you scared? I want a drink. I know you do. And what I witnessed was what a trusted servant does in Alcoholics Anonymous. He called his wife, said, take me off the calendar, and you know, he took me to three meetings, fed me three times. I drank 700 cups of coffee that day, and I felt like a part of AA. You know, and day seven, I can remember these days like it just happened last week. I met my new group, all new people. I still don't know what's going on. I am what Ed might know the answer to this. There used to be a term we used to in the Northeast to describe alcoholism when they used to say I was mocus. Now, I don't know what mocus means, but it's... sounds like a perfect description of a guy like me who's just shot out and doesn't know what the hell is going on, but sober. And on day seven, you know, I'm in this meeting, this group. We had smoking back then from the top of the tables to the ceiling. I never smoked a cigarette in my life, so, you know, it was kind of weird. But this guy, Richie, walks up to me and goes, hey, I want you to take the job as the ashtray cleaner. And I'm in my head saying, you're out of your mind. I'm not cleaning ashtrays for that specific reason. I never smoked. What do I have to do that for? What I didn't understand was this man was trying to pull me into you. He was trying to give me a responsibility. He was trying to pull me into the middle of the herd. And what I could tell you is I said yes. And from that day, on day seven, to this moment right now, I've been tethered to Alcoholics Anonymous through a commitment. Whether it's in my home group, my district, my area, I've been involved the whole time. I've made myself available because this is what these men would show me to do. That if you want to stay in the game, you got to be in the game. You know, there's enough people on the fringes of Alcoholics Anonymous, you got to get in the herd. And I understood the herd mentality. I see that here this weekend, you know, that we all have to be together, right? And so my life in AA starts, and, you know, believe it or not, a couple of months later, I'm sober. I run into the wife I walked out on. And she says to me, I heard you're getting sober. And what I thought she said was, why don't you move back home right now? It's weird. What were you? But we did get back together, but it took a while. She joined Al-Anon. I was going to my meetings. We did outside therapy. And I moved back with my wife. And you know, I got a great job. I got a haircut. My education came back. We hit those two little AA babies, so we're now 36 and 33. I mean, life just got really good externally. And to the untrained eye, it looks like normal living is a solution to alcoholism. But at 5 years without a drink, I got a rope. I just need a bridge to jump off. Because I'm dying of something we're not talking about in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in my neighborhood. And what that is untreated alcoholism. You see, again, the delusion that I think abstinence is the solution to a spiritual malady. The truth of the matter is, I'm just not drinking. And yeah, we can't, you know, not drinking going to meetings is a very important suggestion. But the truth of the matter is, I'm in the rooms of AA and I'm dying. And see, now my ego and my pride has come back. And I sit in rooms like this. How's it going, Jimmy? Everything's fine as the veins are about to explode out of my neck because I'm too afraid to come to you. I'm too afraid to come to John. John, I'm screwed up. Help me. You know, I'm too afraid to come to the men in the meetings and talk about what's going on. The pride is killing me. My ego is killing me, and I don't even see it. And I do a talk on step two. I lied to everyone in that meeting that day because I'm paralyzed by what you think of me. I read the 12 and 12. I could throw some lines out. I could tell a joke or two if I need to. At the end of the meeting, there's a long line. They're all shaking my hand. Good job. Good God. This guy walks up to me. I'm 6'4". He's 6'4". He just looks at me and goes, and since we're being recorded, he says, you're screwed. But a little bit salty of language. I want to start a fist fight in rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous because I don't know how to face confrontation without violence. I don't know how to face resistance without resistance. But again, I learned my first lesson that God does for me what I can never do for myself because I look at this gentleman and I said, you're right. I need help. And I find myself in a railroad room apartment that next day on the Hudson River on the Jersey side. And I'm getting that spiritual test, maybe a test that some of you guys have gotten or have given. This guy's asking me a few questions. First question he asked me, how long can you hold your breath? How long can you hold your breath? How long can you be in a 12-step program and not work the 12 steps? What does your relationship with God look like? Well, I believe in God. I'm a Catholic, but what's God have to do with any of this? What makes you alcoholic, he asked me. The best I could stammer out of my mouth was, I drink too much. I had no idea about the physical allergy. I had no idea about the mental obsession. I had no idea what makes me alcoholic. I think just drinking makes me alcoholic. I didn't know any of the other components to that. And then he looked at me and said, Jimmy, if AA works, why do you have so many problems? Because I'm not working that yet. I've fallen under that delusion. I think abstinence is a solution to my problem. And what happened to me, and what I'll talk about the rest of the weekend, is what occurred in that kitchen table in his house that day. You know, we started to talk about a lot of things. By the end of that conversation, he had me so far painted into the corner that I had no choice but to take one of those two alternatives. Jimmy, spiritual life, spiritual death. Which one do you want? Nowhere in our literature, nowhere in that book, does it say anything about AA getting us to quit drinking. It says quite the opposite. You will drink again. Lack of power is your dilemma. You have no mental defense against the first drink. Without a psychic change, you're pretty well screwed. You see, what AA is designed is to wake us up to that great reality. That we need to tap into a power greater than ourselves, into a God of our own understanding. That's the beauty of AA. And when he brought me into that chapter, We Agnostics, that was the wake-up call. Because I think God doesn't want to do anything with a guy like me. I think I'm spiritually disqualified because I'm a thief, I'm a crook, I'm all the, I got the long list of all the things I've done in my life. Why would God help a guy like me? Why would God help a guy like me? Why not? Why not? And I couldn't see the truth. And I'll never forget getting on my knees with this guy and holding his hands, taking that third step prayer. In order to get free, Jimmy, he would say, you have to go into the darkness of your life. We have to uncover, discover, and discard the things in our lives that are blocking us from God. One of the best readings I've ever read in any of our literature is out of a book called Daily Reflections. And if you turn to May 1st and read the second paragraph, it says, "It's the side of myself that I refuse to look at that rules me. I must be willing to look at the dark side in order to heal my mind and my heart, because that's the road to freedom. I must walk into darkness to find the light, and walk into fear to find peace." And the way the old timers would say that is AA is like a big bonfire. And there's a lot of people walking around the fire, but eventually the fire is going to burn out. If you really want to change, if you really want to grow, if you really want a relationship with God, you have to walk through the fire and get your ass burnt and feel the uncomfortability of change. But there's one thing I can't do for anyone in this room. None of you could do it for me, and none of you could do it for each other. And that's put willingness in your heart. Willingness is an inside job. And what makes us willing? Well, my good friend Ralph likes to say a good whooped ass. We're being sick and tired of being sick and tired, right? Circumstances make me willing. Being sober 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, nothing's changing in my life. And really, that's where I was at. And I was willing to go into the light. I was willing to go into the dark. You know, he said to me, there's two goals in Alcoholics Anonymous. His opinion, kind of my opinion today. First goal, don't pick up the first drink, the obvious one. But the second goal is the goal that everyone in this room wants to attain, whether you know it or not. And that's to step out there in the sunlight of the Spirit to that place. That place where freedom happens, that place where the bondage of self gets removed, that place where we get placed in a place of neutrality, safe and protected when it comes to a drink. Bill Wilson called it the perfect place, utopia. But in order to get out there, you know, I got to walk through the darkness of my life like this reading says. I got to uncover, discover, and discard the things that are blocking me from God and blocking me from you. Because I can't never forget that alcoholism is a soul sickness caused by a separation from God and from so the walls have to come down. And I don't know about what your walls are. I'll tell you what my walls are. The walls of alibis. The walls of excuses. The walls of blame. The walls of justification. The walls of rationalization. And the walls of victimization. I had to get down to causes and conditions of the things that were blocking me from God and real freedom in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Are you willing to pay the price? This was the question. And I got on my knees with this gentleman. I've been in a million prayer circles at this point. I've held men's hands all the time. We say the Lord's Prayer, Semiramis Prayer, Third Step Prayer, Seventh Step Prayer. But this was different. I was on my knees and I was holding this man's hands. And I was impressed that he could say the Third Step Prayer. I had to read it out of the book because I didn't know it. 5 years sober, I didn't even know the prayer was in the book. And was saying that prayer and I could feel his spirit come into my spirit. When I got off my knees, he says, okay, it's time to go in. And what I'll talk about the rest of this weekend is really the things I had to start to look at to get free. I talk a lot about my old man. I had daddy issues. Anyone else in here have daddy issues? I got daddy issues. You might have mommy issues. You might have sibling. You might have a lot of issues. But until I saw the truth about that stuff, I wasn't going to change in the rooms of alcohol. I wasn't going to be free. See, the intent is not to feel better. The intent is not to have relief. The intent is to be free. What's the price you're willing to pay to be free? And what I had to pay was to take a look at these things and get down to causes and conditions of the things that made me the way I was. And it wasn't without the help of another guy. So, you know, so this weekend, I hope that, you know, everyone, if you have something heavy on your heart, I hope to talk about it. Right? I hope you share it. And don't minimize what you might feel. Or you might think, or what you're going through. Don't say it's not a big deal. Yeah, it's a big deal. It's a real big deal. That's why you're here. God has you in this place for a reason this weekend. So I hope that all of us can get around and talk about the things that are really going on in our life. You know, it is tough being a sober man. I don't mean a man that doesn't drink. I'm talking about the guy who's a sober man. Back to those questions. How are you showing up? Am I a sober man in my family? Am I a sober dad, a sober husband, a sober... Am I being accountable for the way I'm thinking, acting, feeling? Spiritual experience is all about changing that, transforming that, how we feel, how we act, how we believe. Am I willing to do that? Am I willing to put my life on the line with that stuff? But then more importantly, am I being of service to God and others? We have three purposes in Alcoholics Anonymous. Primary purpose, singleness of purpose, and real purpose. And real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and others. Can't be of maximum service when I'm not doing the work that this book is asking me to do. Right? And this is not the treasure. My sponsor is very clear on that. This is the map to the treasure, right? And, you know, the treasure is to have this relationship with God, have this relationship with you, and to be relatively free. And I think that's why we go on retreats. I'm not here for the cookies and the snacks, though I'll eat the cookies and the pretzels and all that other stuff. You know, we'll laugh, we'll cut up, we'll bust balls here. That's what we do, right? We'll talk about the Rangers beating the Florida Panthers again at some point. You non-hockey fans. But why do we come to these things? Is it to get away from my wife? Is it boys' weekend away? Or is it really a time of reflection, contemplation, and meditation? Is this a place to get closer to God or not? I mean, you know, and I'll be the first to tell you that I dialed it in a few times. I just came up to hang with the guys on a weekend. Truth of the matter is I never got anything out of these weekends when I just came to hang with the guys. But when I got into the groups and I started to talk to you and I started to talk and others talked to me and, you know, that's where the magic lies. And so I hope you all have a magical weekend. I all hope that you get off your chest what might be on your chest. And if nothing's on your chest, maybe God has you to use your ears to listen to somebody else. So that's all I got. Thank you.